Gonna start the show, and I'm going to actually, oh, says it's recording. Good morning, everybody. This talk that I'm going to give today is actually an introductory talk to a series that I'm doing at my home church that starts this Wednesday. They've very graciously allowed me to present a series on sexual apologetics. Many of you were there and saw my talk for the Paradoxes class last year, the one on Adam and Eve and Christian sexuality in Genesis, and the other one on the science of the mind and belief and how we get to a point where people believe some of these things regarding sexuality that are so untrue. And those two talks are going to be incorporated into this. This is a continuation, but let me give this disclaimer at the very beginning. When I talk about this, I am not setting myself up as an authority on human sexuality. It's not the same as when Dr. Ross talks about astrophysics, where he's an authority. My field of expertise is neuroradiology, so I'm quite versed in neuroscience and brain science, but not in human sexuality. But that doesn't disqualify me from talking on this issue, because I am a physician with 40 years of practice, and also some of the best communication in science is not done by scientists, but people that are science reporters who just take all this information and then translate it into language that can be understood by lay people. So if I have a role here, think of me more as a reporter, a science reporter, than someone claiming to be an authority on all these issues. The seminar is going to be a 7-week series, and this is going to be the opening talk, the top 10 myths of the sexual revolution. And you can see here what the next 6 weeks are going to be. And when I first conceptualized this talk, I was going to say the top 10 lies. And you know, I really hate that word. It's so pejorative. And when you say a lie, it implies that the person who tells it knows that it's not true. And we can seldom really get into the mind of another person to know whether they're deliberately lying or they've just deceived themselves and honestly believe what they're saying. So I'm going to call this the top 10 myths of the sexual revolution. Now, for the course series, I'm putting up an outline on my website at swilling.com. And there's a button menu on the top that says resources for the sexual apologetics seminar. And each week is broken down with links. You can email me at steve@willing.org. And then I've listed some really good resources for this whole subject. The Christian Medical and Dental Association for many years has been running articles addressing matters pertaining to human sexuality, particularly in the LGBT issue, homosexuality, less just defending traditional morality, but they do have some of that. Another source that does a great job in covering this is National Review. Breakpoint from the Colson Center, that started with Chuck Colson himself and now is kept alive by John Stone Street, is an excellent source. And I recommend everybody I talk to who's interested in Christian worldview and apologetics to subscribe to that daily email, because for me, it's a great source. They lead me to some of these sources that I'm using. So a lot of times they're the first place that I go to. Now, I don't stop there. Usually I will read the books that they mention. I'll also pull up a lot of articles and try and read as many of the original articles as I can that are relevant to what I'm talking about. The Public Discourse is another really good source from the Witherspoon Institute. And then over the course of the upcoming 7-week series, I'll mention a lot of books, including today, that are recommended readings, because nobody's going to be an expert on all of this. And the reason I'm doing this even today is not to make you an expert, but a talk like this is not designed to equip you to be an effective apologist so you can argue with people who are very committed to the secular sexual agenda. The purpose of a talk like this is really for within the church, something for our young people and young adults to encourage them and keep them strong in the faith and protect them from being deceived. And for many, maybe most, this would be all that's required is just to go through and skim the surface. But for somebody who really wants to get in there and dive in deep into the arguments and debates, it takes a lot more expertise. Some of these fields are extremely complicated, and there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of articles on any of these, and there's a lot of cherry picking that goes on, and we have to be honest and try and avoid that. So you've all heard of something called the sexual revolution. Well, it's an interesting term. It has a long philosophical history. The actual phrase, the sexual revolution, is attributed to Wilhelm Reich, who wrote this book about the cultural struggle on sexuality in 1936. He was an Austrian, sort of a second generation psychoanalyst after Sigmund Freud. Like Freud, he had a lot of very strange beliefs and actually ended up dying in jail. But they didn't invent this. I mean, some say that the first real sexual revolution was the impact of Christianity upon pagan culture, because anything that you might see today in secular culture regarding sexuality is nothing new. It would have been throughout history and rampant before Christianity came onto the scene. But there is a more recent sexual revolution that took off really in the 20th century. And you can read books about this. Carl Truman's book, On the History of Thought, How We Got the Identity book, Global Sexual Revolution by Gabrielle Kubi. Jennifer Roback Morse has a book called The Sexual State. And there are books that go into detail about the philosophical history of that. And it's interesting from a historical standpoint, but from an apologetic standpoint, really has very little value because people don't read, nobody's read Wilhelm Reich. The majority of people are getting their beliefs are not from these philosophers, but from pop culture and peer groups. And so knowing that information is not helpful from an apologetic standpoint. It's just interesting from a historical standpoint. So what is the sexual revolution when I'm talking about it? What the sexual revolution is that I'm talking about was the rejection of Judeo-Christian sexual morality, the disentanglement of sex from marriage and children. And as we talk about this, realize that it's not a relentless ongoing thing. I mean, there's so much despair and so much pessimism in the Christian church today that really shouldn't be, because it came and went. I mean, there was definitely a spike of, say, sexual promiscuity in the 60s and 70s. And when you look at some of these scandals, like the Boy Scout abuse scandal and the Catholic priest scandal, there was a definite peak in the 70s and 80s, and then it subsided. Divorce rates now are actually going down. Abortion rates are going now, not just simply because fewer women are getting pregnant, but the percentage of pregnancies that lead to abortion have gone down. It was French beaches and many beaches around the world became renowned for toplessness in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that is very much on the decline. Surprisingly, women started getting uncomfortable with the fact that men were leering at them, like, what else would you have expected? So there's actually been, in many cultural realms, a retreat from some of this. So it's not a relentless thing. Right now, we just kind of fixated on the trans issue and gay marriage, and that's certainly on the rise, but a lot of the other negative elements to the sexual revolution are on the decline. So it's not a relentless thing. So when I'm talking about it, what the sexual revolution consists of is, number one, the rupture of the tie between sex and children. This was made possible by the pill. You could have sex and it would not lead to children. The second was the rupture of the tie between marriage and children that came through divorce and illegitimacy. And we don't talk enough about divorce, and it's a very sensitive subject because most people who experience it, it's a very painful thing. And sometimes it seems like there's a no-win situation. It only takes one to break up a marriage. It doesn't take two. And illegitimacy, but the rupture between marriage and children was a part of that. And the third one is then the severance of the tie between marriage and sex. And that didn't come from a technology. It didn't come from laws. It primarily just emerged as a result of pop culture because, I mean, humans are just like that. It's our sin nature. I mean, we deep down, most people would like to have a situation where you could have sex whenever you want with whomever you wanted. So that's really not a tough sell if you don't have some overriding ethic to restrain those impulses. From a historical standpoint, it was really interesting. If you've read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, he wrote that in 1932, and in his future dystopia, look what they did with this. They completely eliminated marriage. In fact, monogamy was frowned upon, and you would fall under the eye of the authorities if you spent too much time with a single person. Sex was completely disengaged from marriage, and sex was completely disengaged from children. The children were raised in hatcheries by communities, not conceived by sex and raised in families. So what did the sexual revolution lead to? Well, mostly sex outside of marriage. And so we have these Venn diagrams and it breaks up. Now, you know, still most most sexual activity takes place within marriage, but there's a lot of sexual activity that takes outside of marriage. And again, there's not a complete rupture between marriage and children. Most children, even today, are born to married parents. They may not make it to adulthood with intact families, but most children, even today, in the Western society, are born to intact married families. And in African and Asian cultures, it's even a much stronger link. So what I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes are going quickly through the top 10 myths of the sexual revolution. And these are not organized like in a countdown, what's the biggest lie or what's the most damaging. I'm going to organize them more thematically rather than by significance. Now, again, it's not to make you an expert in any of these, but I'm going to tell you just a capsule summary of what the argument is and where you can go for more information. And again, my primary purpose is to uphold and defend biblical sexuality within the church by showing that the science supports the scriptural perspective. Now, I've written a lot about biases and sound thinking and how people misuse data and deceptive data. How do we know here that I'm not doing the same thing? Is my whole presentation just an exercise in motivated cognition and cherry picking and confirmation bias? And there are some reasons why I think we can say that that is not the case. First, you can look at who is on our side in this. Almost all religious faiths, many political persuasions. This doesn't break evenly, say, along Republicans versus Democrats. This is not fault breakdown upon racial lines. These principles have been universally accepted through most of history by most cultures. You can also look at who is not on our side. And what we see are highly biased individuals with highly transparent agendas, typically money or just justifying their own particular lifestyles. A third, our evidence is just common sense. You can look around and see what is happening with society and that some of these just should be intuitively obvious, even though they do get challenged. A fourth reason is that nothing I say here requires postulating some great conspiracy or invoking invisible actors, like a lot of the things that, say, might raise my hackles when I see controversial subjects brought up, when they're invoking these things. This doesn't require invisible actors or conspiracies. And the last thing is that most motivated cognition, most biases are self-serving in nature. And I think we'd have to honestly say that a conservative sexual ethic runs against most people's self-serving bias. So let me go right in. What is the first myth that I'm going to cite? Well, the first myth is gender is a social construct. So what does that mean? Well, feminism is broken up into waves. And the first wave feminism was the women's suffrage movement, the right to vote, property rights for women, equality in the workplace, allowing women to have the same rights and privileges that men did. That is something that Christians should support. And that is not the sexual revolution. They try and say that that was a sexual revolution, but that's an equivocation fallacy. The first wave feminism carried on through most of the 20th century. Then there's something they call the second wave feminism. The second wave feminism is the more problematic one. What second wave feminism did, represented by people such as Simone de Beauvoir, who I referenced in the talk I gave before, is that there is fundamentally no difference at all between men and women, that all social differences are constructed, imposed by society, that if you give little boys dolls and you give little girls trucks, then they will grow up to be exactly the same in all regards. And that is wildly unscientific. And you might also note that that completely contradicts what are now the axioms of transgenderism, which is arguing the exact opposite, that the two genders plus the many other genders that they invoked are biologically based. But still, so there's this contradiction, and that's one reason not to be so pessimistic, because many of these causes are at odds with each other, not just with us. So I said, I'm not going to go into detail on this. I will in future talks, but here's a good resource for this particular subject, the book Why Gender Matters by Leonard Sachs, who has a long history of researching in this area, and he's spoken to many groups, especially school groups, teacher groups, because his main interest is in education and giving young boys and young girls the best opportunities they have, because what he has found and what the science shows is that decades of research in neuroscience confirm that there are concrete, persistent, and pervasive differences between male and female cognition, between how men and women think. And these cannot be socially acquired. First, we see that we observe these tendencies even in other animals and in primates who don't have, obviously, our social structures and television and children's toys. Now, on the other hand, gender roles are definitely influenced by culture. For instance, I might cite to you, if you look in Victorian England, a secretary was almost always a male. You know, it was just in the 20th century West that secretaries were all female. Nursing profession did start mostly female, but it doesn't have to be. And you know, so many of these gender roles, we don't need to sanctify them and say that they're biblical. Men and women are different, but we're not talking, there's very little that are a very rare situation where there might be an absolute dividing wall. One of the biggest dividing walls is probably in sex drive. And another big one is aggression. But things like empathy versus systematic thinking, there are big bell curves, and there's a lot of overlap between men and women in these regards. Now, the very few people that oppose this anymore, this idea that gender is a social construct, are activists, politicians, columnists, but not scientists. This was a hallmark issue. The January 2017 issue of the Journal of Neuroscience Research was entirely dedicated to dozens of articles reviewing the difference between male and female brains. In the opening talk here, the headline here on the front, an issue whose time has come, sex gender influences on nervous system function. Larry Cahill, the editor, said that the notion that sex matters fundamentally, powerfully, and pervasively for all of neuroscience, not just for reproduction, is an idea whose time has indeed come. Now, this message hasn't necessarily gotten through. Like I said, most of the media and education establishment are still living in the 80s and think that all the differences between boys and girls are social constructs. But we know from neuroscience that that's not possible, that the infant brain is bathed in hormones and the infant male is subjected to the effect of testosterone, and that has a dramatic impact upon the development of the brain, both in utero and in the early postnatal period. It subsides for some time, and then there's another peak in adolescence. So there are structural, and not so much structural as definite biochemical and hormonal differences that affect the development of male and female brains. Myth number two, intercourse between consenting adults is harmless. That was a big part of the sexual revolution, that there should be no constraints. There's no reason you should have to be married because it's like shaking hands or, you know, giving somebody a back rub, that sexual intercourse is no more significant than that. And any objection to that is just puritanical and repressive. Here's a good book. Joe McElhaney, now in its second edition, this newest edition just came out in 2019, updates research of about 20 years since their first edition. Some of the many consequences of non-marital intercourse include sexual transmitted diseases, which simply cannot be propagated within a population if everybody were monogamous. Pregnancy and its obvious consequence, emotional consequences. People bond, and then there is tremendous pain that occurs when these sexual relationships are broken up. We can look at this from the neuroscience angle, that sexual intercourse results in a release of dopamine, and dopamine is the reward centers of the brain. That is, dopamine is what gets activated by risk takers, by skydivers. It gets by gamblers, by addicts. Anything that causes a release of dopamine within the brain causes the brain to want more of that activity. And sex obviously is one of those things that can cause a dopamine release. The other is the impact of oxytocin, which sometimes popularly is referred to as the cuddle hormone, but it causes bonding between individuals who engage in sexual intercourse. And obviously, that's something much more significant than just giving a back rub. And when it's designed by God to bond a married couple together in a lifetime of commitment and love, but when it's engaged in by people with no prospects of marriage, results in a bond that's going to be very painful when it gets broken. And then there are the social consequences of non-marital intercourse, the social pressures, the conflicts, crime, acts of violence, partner abuse, so many things that are related to this. The third, myth number three, marriage is just a piece of paper. Who says that? That's the implication here is that cohabitation is just the same. And if two people love each other, they can just move in. And it doesn't really matter that much whether they get married or not. That's just how they're seen in the eyes of the law. The ones who are most likely to invoke this are young men who want to keep their options open and don't want to be committed to one particular woman, but you will hear that a lot. Well, what does the science say? What does the sociology say? This is an excellent book. It's now about 20 years old, but it doesn't mean that the data is 20 years old. If any, this was sort of the cutting edge of what has become an onslaught in the last 20 years. I just haven't been able to find a more current book that reviews all this. And it didn't need to be redone because the principles have held up. what Linda Waite and Maggie Gallagher wrote about. Linda Waite was a researcher who was the primary investigator for many of the studies that are cited, that marriage itself leads to higher levels of commitment. It is more other focused, it is safer and leads to greater prosperity. And I say, well, compared to what? Well, let's say compared to cohabitation. Relationships based on cohabitation without marriage are inherently less committed. They're less likely to survive. The partners are more likely, much more likely to cheat on one another, more likely the guy, but both. Well, they're less stable. I mean, they come and go. They can have multiple relationships. They may separate and come back together again. They're less interdependent. Cohabitators tend to be highly individualistic and want to maintain their personal lifestyles, their personal hobbies, their circle of friends. And married people gravitate towards having shared friends, shared activities, mutual dependency, shared bank accounts. It's this interdependence that is very powerful and is very lacking in cohabitating relationships. They are also more violent. And there are some theories as to why that may be. It may be that the males feeling a lower level of commitment feel like they have less to lose if they blow up and have an outburst. Whatever the explanation is, the fact that they are more violent is not a matter of dispute. The last objection that comes up is, well, maybe there's a selection bias. Maybe people who get married are just better people to start with. And, you know, the ones who cohabitate are the bad apples. But they've even built a strong case and looked at the evidence to test that alternative hypothesis, to test that counterfactual. And in prospective serial studies, they have found that marriage actually changes people when they follow them over a period of time. This is myth number four. Since I numbered on these slides a countdown, I'll just go with a countdown. So counting down to seven, the sexual revolution was a boon for women. And you've all heard that. And what is mostly based on is I explained the difference between first wave feminism and second wave feminism. Well, this is a very different thing. You know, first wave feminism was a boon for women, but it just had nothing to do with the sexual revolution. In fact, you know, the early first wave feminists were adamantly pro-marriage, anti-abortion. And first wave feminism was indeed a boon for women. But this is a huge equivocation fallacy to co-opt that movement and claim credit for the outcome of the sexual revolution and second wave feminism. What we do know is far from being a boon for women, that women's happiness has declined significantly. There is a paper entitled The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness, published by Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson in 2009 in the American Economic Journal. They found from 1975 to 2010, women's happiness declined both in absolute terms and relative to men throughout the industrialized revolution. So not only did their happiness decline, it declined faster than happiness of men declined. So it wasn't just a result of a global, everybody was less happy. Women were more unhappy. Rising incidence of mental illness among women throughout this time period. With the sexual revolution and the opportunity for men to get sex without commitment, the chances of women ever being married decreases. Certainly, marriage ages are postponed. With less chance of becoming married and less chances and getting married at a later age, fertility declines, so there are decreased chances of motherhood, increased chances of victimization. While sexual or spousal abuse within marriage is a very real thing, that has to be put into perspective. You have to eliminate the base rate fallacy. You have to look at, well, compared to what? And when you compare the safety of women within marriages to the safety of single women or women in cohabitating relationships, women within a marriage relationship are by far least likely to become victims of rape, sexual abuse, spousal abuse, partner abuse, or violent crime of any sort. So it is the fact that it's been a boon for women is, you know, a huge myth. Here's a little bit of data, just sort of a teaser, really. New York Times reported, I think about 3 years ago, American women are having fewer children than they like. Most women want to, the average out, so the number of children women say they want ranges between 2 and 3, averaging out 2.7. The one that they'll probably have is between 1 and 2. And the gap here on the right, I don't know if you see my pointer here, the gap between the number of children they say they want to have and the one they probably will have is really quite large. Now, I you know, look at this chart and you can't say, well, it's really dramatically decreased from, say, 1970, but the sexual revolution was already well underway by this point. Here's a good one. Chastity and monogamy are oppressive. Halfway through here, what's the context of this? Well, the context for this is there was this movement within the early psychoanalytic community pioneered by people like Sigmund Freud, who thought, you know, any restraint upon sexuality led to, was repressive and therefore negative for your mental health, that any attempt to restrict sex to marriage was going to lead to negative mental health consequences. You know, the major proponents of that, of course, are predatory males who want to have all their options and want to have sex whenever they can with whomever they can. But let's take the counterfactual. Let's test that hypothesis. Well, what are the alternatives? And it turns out they've all been tried and the outcomes were uniformly horrendous. In Imperial Rome, Harper wrote a book I'll show you. In Imperial Rome, it was a sexual free-for-all for powerful men, for high-ranking, wealthy, or important men. But if you were female, if you were a slave, then you were there basically just to gratify their options. There is talking about, they mentioned how, say, homosexuality was accepted in the Roman Empire, but that's actually very misrepresentative of the true situation. The fact that it was mostly that the powerful men were indiscriminate to whom they might use to relieve their sexual tensions. And sometimes adolescent males who are of lower rank or slaves were at the receiving end of that, but very few. It was almost unheard of to have men who exclusively had sex with other men. More recently was tried in post-revolutionary Russia. There was a time immediately after the Russian Revolution under Lenin where they attempted to make divorce widely available, attempted to eliminate all restraints on sex, they tried to eliminate marriage, and it was a catastrophe. It lasted less than 10 years. The end result was an epidemic of sexually transmitted diseases, of orphan children, of children with no parents, of violence, of rape. It was a social catastrophe. And as a result, they rebounded to become highly restrictive. And that persisted throughout, right up into the fall of the Soviet Union. Many people will say, well, you know, if you restrict sexuality to marriage, then you're just like the Soviets. Well, they're missing the point that the Soviets learned the hard way. It wasn't really part of their essential nature to support Christian sexual morality. The facts, though, are that married people are happier, healthier, and enjoy better sex lives, and in turn, societies are more stable. Christianity didn't impose the patriarchy. It overturned it. And this is a book that I referenced, Kyle Harper. He's a sociologist. He's actually a classical historian at the University of Oklahoma. And he's written this really detailed book about how sex was written about, how it was treated, how it was practiced during the early years of the Roman Empire, how it was overturned by Christianity, and how the transformation didn't occur overnight, but over a period of centuries. In fact, the only ones who are the losers in the Christian sexual morality are the male sexual predators. Counting down, number five on the list, the myth, we're not responsible for sexual predators. So where we come up with that one? Well, I mean, we all know that many celebrities have been found guilty of sexual predation. We also know that violent crime rates have gone up. We know that there was this epidemic of abuse in the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts and really throughout society. It's just that these are the ones that are most publicized. And they know that this has happened, what they want. And so the obvious logical consequence is to say, well, you had this thing called the sexual revolution. What did you expect? So they're sensitive to that, and they don't want us to get away with blaming them for it. So how do they explain sexual predators? And they some of the arguments they come up with are really kind of hilarious. There's a good documentary I saw it on Amazon about Harvey Weinstein and details the history of his relationships with people. And their solution at the end, they interpret it as a simply in terms of power, that Harvey Weinstein, this great producer, had power. And the solution was to have more female producers and more female directors. And I mean, that's really kind of lame if you even think about it. Yeah, that might help in some of the marginal cases. If you're talking about the starlets who slept with him to get a role, but there'd still be male producers. And how does that really help the, you know, that might help the supreme select sliver of top society who are Hollywood starlets, but how does that help the millions of ordinary women across the country or the hotel maids or other lower ranking people who are victims of these predators? The second way they try and do it is they say, well, we have to focus more on consent. And I'm going to talk a lot more about this in a future talk. I'm going to have a whole talk on sexual predators, but consent is a very problematic area because it's not a binary. It's an either or kind of thing. And how do people consent? You know, if a woman is drunk, obviously, maybe she's not able to consent, but if the man's drunk, how do you blame him? That's not a very good way to prevent sexual predation if that's the only pillar you're going to lean against. The third one they come up with, we blame it on toxic masculinity. And, you know, in a way, I agree with them. But what they would call toxic masculinity, which I think is a terrible word, I would just call misogyny. But what they want to do is they want to equate toxic masculinity with traditional biblical masculinity. And again, that's a complete equivocation fallacy. I mean, honestly, there's no way any rational person could equate beating women with declining to ordain women as priests within the church. Those are total apples and oranges kind of things. And that's an absolute equivocation fallacy. What the science has shown, they've developed a model. It's called the confluence model. That's actually what it's named, the confluence model. It doesn't describe anything. It's just what they call it. And this, we'll talk about this in a future talk. If you want to explain sexual predation, you have to look at the predators, and they've done that. And they've identified three elements that are preeminent in the development of sexual predators. The first is misogyny. It's males who have a very negative, demeaning view of women. The second is casual sexual orientation. This is not sexual preference, like same sex versus opposite sex. What is their attitude towards sexual intercourse in general? Is it a very serious, solemn thing to be shared within a committed relationship? Or is it, again, like I said at the beginning, just a back rub or shaking hands? The more they think of it as a trivial, insignificant thing, the more likely they are to resort to sexual predation. And the third is pornography. It's been now very strongly linked to the development of sexual predators. And I'm going to address that a little bit again in a moment in more detail in a later talk. That leads us to one, and this is a common one. Pornography doesn't hurt anyone. Well, what's the context for that? Again, they want to have the pornography, and they don't want us or any conservatives saying, well, this is contributing to sexual abuse. Now, this has been debated for a long time, and supposedly it was settled. You know, supposedly in the 90s and early 2000s, the studies showed that pornography didn't lead to a risk of sexual predation. Well, some of that is because pornography has changed. If they were doing the research in the 70s, and I don't know if any of you date back, if you ever laid eyes on a Playboy magazine from the 70s, which as a kid, occasionally that crossed my path, there is no comparison between the Playboy magazine of the 70s and the pornography that's on the internet today. There is no comparison at all. So maybe that's why the early studies didn't show it, but the evidence has been completely compelling in the last 10 years. Pornography has gotten much worse. And, you know, here are some of the facts. There's a good website. Here's a book, Your Brain on Porn. They also have a website that you can go to, yourbrainonporn.com. I'd recommend it highly. But pornography leads to addiction. Repeated use of pornography causes males to not respond to more mundane sexual stimuli, but require a higher and higher level of stimulation to become aroused. It's obviously harmful to relationships and makes it much more difficult for them to have a healthy relationship with a person of the opposite sex. And it is strongly linked to development of sexual predators, as I mentioned. Here's just a screenshot from yourbrainonporn.com. And it's, I don't expect you to read this. It's just kind of impress you with the level of detail that's on here. And all these bullet points are listing damaging consequences. And then they link to reviews of the scientific data on that. And again, it's a major problem. Counting down now, down to number three, the children will be fine. I mean, these aren't ranked in order, but if I was going to rank them in order of importance, I think this would be the worst. The children are not fine. Now, who wants to say that the children are fine? The ones who want to justify divorce, who want to justify gay adoption, the ones who are anti-family activists, those who want to destroy, you know, Marxists, some of the original BLM people who want to abolish the nuclear family, they say the children will be fine, but the children are not fine by any respect. They suffer when they arise in a single pregnancy situation without a mother or without a father. They suffer from divorce. They suffer from being pawns, commodities in the fertility industry. They suffer from declining birth rates when children are actually better when they have brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins. And when you have a whole generation of only children, like in China, you have an entire generation with no brothers, no sisters, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, because you have to have more than one child for those things to happen. Katie Foss is around. She's been interviewed on the CMDA, Christian Medical Dental Association website. I think John Stone Street has had her. She's been around quite a bit. Katie Foss is a very interesting lady. She was born in an intact family, but her mother left sort of as Katie was an adult and her mother went into a lesbian relationship. So she knows what she's talking about. And this book is a powerful indictment of how children have been shortchanged throughout this whole movement. They suffer from even the ones who are, you know, come out of the fertility industry, the embryo adoption, the sperm donation. These kids grow up suffering from a loss of genetic identity. You know, 40 years ago, sperm donation seemed pretty innocuous, but it turns out that kids, when they grow up, want to know their identity, and whoever was the source of that sperm to them is their genetic identity, and it's causing a lot of crisis. The safest place for a boy or girl to be is within an intact nuclear family. Anytime you depart from that, whether it's same-sex partnerships, whether it's single parenthood, or any other kind of situation, they're at increased risk of abuse. And I'm going to have a whole talk on the victims of the sexual revolution because the children are near the top of that list. The second to the last, there's no meaningful difference between homosexuality and heterosexuality. You know, it's just like eye color or taste in music. Now, there's no science behind that at all. It's just that it's been driven by popular culture. There are people who really want it to be true, and therefore it must be true in their minds. But this has not been driven by science. It's been driven by an agenda. Now, here's a good book. This is also an older reference, but it's held up. The Use of Scientific Research in the Church's Moral Debate by Stanton Jones and Mark Yarhouse. Now, first of all, when men have sex with men, there are dire biological differences between anogenital intercourse versus vaginal intercourse. A long list of medical complications, and we see things in medicine that are so outrageous and so disturbing, we usually can't talk about them because they're protected under the HIPAA regulations, but we see things that are very disturbing within the homosexual population. Now, there's no dispute that male homosexuality is much more promiscuous among males. And it's not necessarily that their sex drive is higher. It's that a male heterosexual has to find a partner. And within sexual relationships in the heterosexual community, women are more often seen as the gatekeepers. They're a little more resistant and a little more reluctant. They have more at risk. Well, if you have male homosexual relationships, it may or may not be that they have a higher sex drive. But what we do know is that there's no gatekeeper. And that may be the only explanation, the only reason why there's more promiscuity. But it is a fact that it's beyond any dispute that they are more promiscuous. There's no possibility of natural parenthood in any kind of same-sex relationship. So the only pathway is from some sort of adoption. And adoption should exist for one reason only, and that's to serve the best interests of the child, not to meet the parental needs of a parent. And instead, you know, if you have Pete Buttigieg and his partner raising these poor children, these children are consigned to growing up without a mother. And you can't change biology. You can't change God's design. Those children are going to be, they may grow up off all right, but they will forever miss not having grown up with a mother, not knowing who their mother was. There are much higher levels of mental illness within the homosexual community, and that is not in dispute. The reason is in dispute. Now, we might say that it's, you know, comorbidity. It's just that it's inherently less healthy. Now, they say it's because of persecution. It's this minority stress theory because they're disapproved of by society that they have higher mental illness. But the data does not support that minority stress theory so far. And the last one is, that's just the way God made me. This is not just exclusively used by homosexuals, but it's used to rationalize a long list of different behaviors pertaining to same-sex attraction. Both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association say that the causes of same-sex attraction are not known, that it most likely is a combination of nature and nurture, but it's multifactorial. It's certainly not uniquely genetic. If it were uniquely genetic, then there would be a 100% concordance rate between identical twins. In fact, it's well below 25%. There is a slight birth order effect. If a mother has more than one male child, the later born are slightly more likely to be homosexual than the earlier born. There are definite environmental and cultural effects, but that's really, it's not so much a damaging myth as a rationalization that just doesn't make any sense. There's not any single science book that I would talk about that might refute this. I think the only authority for this is this book right here, the Bible. You know, this. And the latest thing that's, you know, been on the radar is transgenderism. And that's purely an ideology. This is not grounded in biology. There is no biological neuroscientific basis for thinking there could be even be such a thing as a male brain inside a female body or vice versa. That's just an ideology. It's just a fantasy. And as to how or why somebody is that way, that's kind of irrelevant to whether it's good for you or not. I mean, there are many things we're born with that are harmful to us. There are many diseases for which there is a genetic factor. There are many that are genetic in nature. And also it misrepresents what human sexuality really is. We want to put everybody in boxes, and you have this homosexual box and you have this heterosexual box, and whatever it was destined from birth, if not conception. And that doesn't square with the science that human sexuality really is very malleable and plastic. And I think it's bad to claim, and very harmful to claim, that people who are, say, homosexual choose that. There's no scientific basis for that, and it's harmful. Many struggle with it, and probably many or most would prefer not to be. And so it's not helpful to use that line of reasoning at all. But how one got there and why one is really irrelevant to whether it's good for you or not, or whether it's moral or immoral. So wrapping it up, the 10 myths: gender is a social construct. I'll be talking about this in weeks 3 and 4. Intercourse between consenting adults is harmless. Marriage is just a piece of paper. The sexual revolution was a boon to women. I'll be talking about all these in weeks 3 and 4. Then we'll move on to chastity and monogamy are oppressive, and we're not responsible for sexual predators, or pornography doesn't hurt anyone, or the children will just be fine. I have a whole talk on the victims of the sexual revolution. The short answer is practically everybody except for sexual predators. And week 6, I'll be talking about heterosexuality, homosexuality, transgenderism, and some of the myths related to that. So, you know, wrapping up, when it comes to sexuality, it's not Christianity that is in conflict with mainstream science. It is the current cultural narrative. And these issues are complex, and I don't want to oversimplify. The opponents can cherry pick data, and they can bolster very compelling arguments to support their preferred narratives. So this is not designed to be the ultimate refutation of every argument. This is a talk that's designed just to confirm Christians that what the Bible has taught and what we believe and what our common sense tells us is supported by the scientific data. So I'm going to stop the PowerPoint and exit the show. And I'm going to end my recording if I can.
Hey,